Thank you for joining us and listening to this message from the Ministry of Grace Providence Church in Cerritos, California. For more information, visit our website at www.graceprovidencechurch.org.
Well, good morning, everybody. Praise the Lord. Good to see you all. I've asked John Dwyer to read the scripture this morning, so he's going to read Acts 19, 23 to 41.
Starting in verse 23, the Word of God says, "About that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades and said, 'Men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. And there is danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great god Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship.' When they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, 'Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!' So the city was filled with confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians who were Paul's companions in travel. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. And even some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now some cried out one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them did not know why they had come together. Some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward. And Alexander was motioning with his hand, wanted to make a defense to the crowd. But when they recognized that he was a Jew, for about 2 hours they all cried out with one voice, 'Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!' And when the town clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, 'Men of Ephesus, who is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash. For you have brought these men here who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemous of our goddess. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open, and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly. For we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there is no cause that we can give to justify this commotion.' And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly." This is the word of God.
This is the last scene now of Paul's ministry in Ephesus, the great city of Asia that he ministered in prior to his coming to the end of his third missionary journey and then his eventual journey to Rome to stand trial. That'll occupy chapters 21 to the end of the book. So this is an interesting account we have here. It's very dramatic. It is interesting because a riot occurred, not nearly on the scale of what we saw in the United States last summer, where there was destruction of property and deaths and so on. It was civil unrest in Ephesus, as you'll see. And it takes place before Paul departs Ephesus. It had the potential of very serious consequences for him had his friends and the disciples not intervened to keep him from going into the theater. He probably would have been killed by this unruly mob. Why did the riot occur? It occurred because of the threat that his message posed to the cult of Artemis, the worship of this goddess. And so this is the climax of chapter 19. You can see Artemis is mentioned five times in this passage that John read. So looking at it, there's three very clear divisions in this section. So my outline is just going to follow those. And I want you to note, first of all, in verses 23 to 28, we have this inflammatory speech by Demetrius. An inflammatory speech. Notice, about that time there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. That's a way of saying there was a big blow-up in the city. No small commotion happened. And now Luke is going to detail it for us. Notice it concerned the way. Remember, we've come across that as we've been going through the book of Acts, this reference to the way. This is the early designation for the Christian movement, for Christianity. It's called the way. The way of Jesus. So it has to do with a lifestyle, but probably also the theology of the way. That Jesus is the only Savior, the only way of salvation, which they capitalized on that in their teaching. So it took on the name the way. So this commotion occurs because of Demetrius. Now, we don't know who this man was, but he is named for us. There is a Demetrius later in John's third letter. He talks about two men with names that start with D, Demetrius and Diotrephes, but it's probably not the same Demetrius. Well, this man was a silversmith, or one who worked with silver. So he was a craftsman. Apparently, there was a trade guild in Ephesus, and he may have been the head of it because he calls this group together, his fellow craftsmen, as though he kind of is presiding over it. It is documented, well documented, I read, that there was a trade of silversmiths in ancient Ephesus. So the details that Luke gives us here, I mean, they're right on. They're spot accurate. Again, affirming to us the truth and the reliability of the New Testament documents. You can trust the New Testament. This is a historical record. The details are accurate. And what was Demetrius' specialty as a silver worker? Well, he made these trinkets of the shrine of Artemis. They could have been souvenirs because the temple of Artemis in Ephesus was a tourist attraction as well as a house of worship. And so people who came to visit the city, they could maybe take home a little trinket of a silver shrine of Artemis with them. Or it could have been used as an amulet, a sort of a superstitious thing to protect one from evil or injury and so on. Could have been a miniature shrine that was used in private, in worship, in one's household, whatever. So he was making these silver shrines of Artemis. Now let's talk about Artemis again. And we'll have a visual of this deity, the female deity, a goddess. It's interesting. I've never seen this name ever in the news or read about it. Yesterday, as I was reading the news, some of you may have caught this, NASA's future program of going to the moon and landing again, the first female astronaut to go to the moon in this future program of NASA, they've called this program, you guessed it, Artemis. And if you look it up, she's also the god, one of the gods of the moon, though I never found that in my study. Rather, they emphasize that she was the goddess of fertility. She was invoked when a woman was in childbirth. They also invoked her to find a husband. She's portrayed as a huntress whose arrows protected virgins. The temple priests of the temple of Artemis, they were female, so we call them priestesses. They were committed to chastity. But this was the deity that was worshipped, most worshipped in private in the Mediterranean world. Archaeologists have found 33 locations in the Mediterranean area where Artemis was worshipped, besides Ephesus. But Ephesus was the center of her worship. And that comes out in the passage. So her image appeared on coins, on papyri, in wall paintings, reliefs, statues, and so on. Parents even named their children after the goddess. There is an Artemis that Paul mentions. It's a man in Titus 3:12. And there's one letter that's different that makes it masculine, but it's pronounced the same. So he gathers together the people of this trade, and typically I read that those who had the same trade, they tended to live together in the same area of town. So it was easy for him to gather the other silversmiths together. Notice what he says that our business. Verse 25, then he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades, said, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. So they were, like many people, using religion to make money. Revenue came into the city of Ephesus. It also made these men who made the shrines or statues of Artemis, it made them money. And they would not have looked kindly on a movement or a teacher who came to Ephesus whose teaching detracted from their business and challenged their economic interests. They would be very unhappy with that. So this is what was going on. Notice what he says about Paul. And here we get an insight into Paul's ministry. Verse 26. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus. Notice what Luke adds to this. Not only in Ephesus, but in all of Asia. Almost all of Asia. Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying, gods made with hands are not gods. So they're summarizing his message of monotheism. Paul had to teach this to the heathen world. He could not assume that they had a theology like the Jews did in the synagogue. Paul didn't have to teach this in the synagogue to his fellow Jews. They already had a biblical basis for the belief in Yahweh. So he didn't have to start there. But when he was in among the Gentile world where the idolatry was rampant, he had to start from scratch. and bring out the problems with idolatry. Why is idolatry something that God says he hates? Let me bring out two problems with it that comes out in this statement. That gods made with hands are not gods. The first thing is, it's an acknowledgement of more than one deity. Notice that plural, gods. But God, the true God, says, there are no gods beside me. I know not any. Quoting him in Isaiah. There's no God beside him. He is the only one true and living God. Now, how can we say that? Because there's only one God by nature. There's only one being that is self-existent, eternal, omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, and so on. You take all those characteristics that belong to deity. There's only one being who possesses those. There's not a multiplicity of gods. There's only one God. There's no God beside him. And then the other problem is making a visible representation of gods, which is strictly forbidden in the second commandment. You shall not make any likeness of anything in heaven above or in earth beneath or under the earth and bow down and worship it. And this is what was true of paganism, of the Gentile world. They made visible representations of their deities. And their deities were just like them. They looked like humans, with the same characteristics. But the thing about God is you cannot make a visible representation of him because he doesn't look like anything we're familiar with. There is nothing in all of creation that looks like Yahweh. You can't make an image of him. How do you make an image of an eternal, infinite spirit that dwells in light that no man can approach, whom no man has seen or can see? You can't make an image of that. But man makes images of the gods that he creates. All the deities of the ancient world were human creations. This is what Paul said. Gods made by hands are no gods. Calvin said that the heart of man is an idol factory. And that's exactly right. Man makes gods that look like himself. And so the folly of idolatry cannot be emphasized enough, and how evil it is and how abominable it is to God. It's that abominable thing that he hates. You can't compare. God is incomparable. Isaiah 40, two times, God asks the question, to whom then will you liken me? Or to what likeness will you compare me to? Isaiah 40, verse 18 and verse 25. Two times he asks that question. So the God of the Bible is incomparable, and he's incomprehensible. You cannot take a being with those characteristics and put it into an image. So Paul's ministry greatly impacted them. Notice Paul worked from a general principle concerning man-made gods. Demetrius goes on, and he says, and there is a danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, that is, they'll be looked upon with dislike, and thus their trade, their business will taper off, and they'll lose money. Not only would that happen, but he says, but also that temple of the great goddess, Artemis. A temple photo may be on the screen behind me. The temple in Ephesus now has been destroyed, but they erected a model of it. If you've ever seen the temple of Athena on the top of the Acropolis, a photo of it, it's huge, the temple of Athena in Athens. This temple in Ephesus was four times as big as that temple, the Parthenon. Four times as big. 127 columns, 60 feet tall. This is why the temple of Artemis in Ephesus was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And what happened there, Demetrius is arguing that the magnificence of this temple might come under, be looked upon differently by people. It's going to lose its magnificence in the eyes of people. And what happened in Ephesus is that the Christian faith eventually supplanted the worship in the temple of Artemis. And this happened throughout the ancient world. By the second century, many of the temples where gods were worshipped were no longer frequented. They weren't sacrificing. Why? Because people were being converted to Christianity in great numbers. And so they were not participating anymore in the worship of their gods. So there was a big change that came into the world. So what happened after this rousing speech of Demetrius? Verse 28. When they heard this, they were enraged. So this is what he wanted to do. He wanted to work the crowd up. And he achieved his goal, this man, by this speech that he gave. He got people on their high horse, thinking irrationally now, because it's turned into a mob, and a mob is not rational. A mob acts according to passion without thinking. So he worked them up. So in verses 29 to 34, we have now the scene changes. It now changes to the theater that is nearby, the town center where this was taking place. And I'm calling this section the mob in the theater. So after they begin crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians," you'll notice at the end, verse 34, they did this for 2 hours. They were chanting this. Verse 29, "So the city was filled with confusion." Chaos now is erupting in the city. This is the language of civil disorder. Demetrius has successfully fomented a riot, which now it's taken a turn. It's now going to be dangerous for Christians in this context. And it ends up in the theater. Now, this theater blew me away. The theater in Ephesus could hold anywhere from 20,000 to 25,000 people. This is actually it, what you're looking at. It's still standing. If you go to Ephesus, Turkey, it's under another name now, you can see this. There's all kinds of photos on the internet of the theater in Ephesus. It is massive. Now, how full did it get? We have no idea. But the crowd, Demetrius worked up his fellow silversmiths, but it also spilled over into the public because they also were concerned about their great temple to Artemis. This was their main attraction for the city. and the God they worshiped. And so there's a great many people who are taking part in this. And Paul, they can't lay their hands immediately on him. Instead, they seize two of his travel companions, and they're named here for us, Aristarchus and Gaius. Who are they? Well, Gaius, for example, he was in Corinth before. He was a convert of Paul back in Corinth. And he became a traveling companion of the Apostle Paul. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 1 that he only baptized Crispus and Gaius and the household of Stephanas. And beside that, he didn't baptize anyone else, for Christ sent him not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, he says of Gaius. He writes of Gaius at the end of Romans 16, Gaius, who is host to me. Now, Paul wrote Romans from Corinth. And so he's in Corinth with Gaius, and he's writing to the Romans, and Gaius sends his greetings, and he says, Gaius was host to me and to the church. So he was an important figure in Paul's life. Aristarchus, he was a Macedonian from Thessalonica, we learn over in the 27th chapter, and he's going to be on board with Paul on his journey to Rome. But Aristarchus, in Colossians 4:10, Paul says of him that he was his fellow prisoner. So it's interesting, you take the things that are said about these individuals in Paul's letters, and you get an insight into more of what's happening in the book of Acts and who these people were. You know, Paul, he didn't shy away from this. He wanted to go in. Here's a great crowd. He wants to go in and speak to them. Maybe he's thinking he could preach again to even more people all at once. But the disciples and the brothers, the Asiarchs, as they're called here, they keep him from going in. I wonder, it would have been probably death for Paul had he gone in. I wonder if this is what Paul's referring to in 1 Corinthians 15:32 when he says he fought with beasts at Ephesus. And in 2 Corinthians 1, 8 to 10, he says, I don't want you to be ignorant of the affliction that we experienced in Asia, that we despaired of life, but God delivered us from deadly peril. I can't help but think that he's referring to what went on there that Luke has not recorded all the details of for us in Ephesus. Who are the Asiarchs who stepped in? Notice, they must have been some friends of Paul. They had some respect for him. These were officials, city officials that were elected. They had something to do with the worship of the emperor. Emperor worship, or they call the imperial cult. They supervised the funds that came in, and they presided at the games and the festivals. So this was a group of city officials, and they protected Paul in Ephesus. Later on, there's an early Christian martyr by the name of Polycarp, a disciple of the Apostle John. It is said that an Asiarch intervened and protected Polycarp from being thrown to the lions. So what this tells me is that the Roman government has not yet turned against Christians at this point. The Asiarchs were defending Paul, protecting Paul. And we're going to see another individual that does it who had even more power and clout in the city. But Rome is still looking at Christianity as sort of a branch of Judaism. And Judaism was a legal religion in the Roman Empire. And so they were not persecuted by the Roman government. And Christianity was the same at this point. But in about 7 years after this, going to completely change under the Emperor Nero. He's the first to go after the Christians. So the assembly was in confusion. Again, a total uproar. Notice the irony of this statement, and is even kind of humorous. Most of those, verse 32, most of them, that is, those who came together in the theater, who got worked up, they're in commotion, they're upset with what's going on, most of them don't even know why. They don't know what the riot's about. Very true, human nature. Now, some in the crowd, now notice this incident here regarding a man named Alexander. And some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward. Notice that. They want Alexander to speak, the Jewish segment of this group. Alexander, the point of what he's going to do, he's going to try to distance the Jewish community here from Paul and the effects of Paul's ministry. Because the Ephesians, they looked down on the Jewish community. They didn't like them because they didn't pay tribute to their god Artemis. So they didn't like Jewish people for that reason. They would not honor Artemis. And so they want Alexander to stand up and speak and let it be known that they're not a part of what Paul is doing. They don't want to be blamed for what Paul was teaching and the effect of his ministry. They are going to distance themselves from the mob. But as soon as he tried to get up and to speak, you notice what happened. They shouted him down. They were chanting. Solid 2 hours. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. So he was not successful. Now the third section begins at verse 35 to the end of the chapter. And we have here the town clerk who gets involved. Now from that language, the town clerk, that doesn't sound real important, but actually, this is the chief magistrate of Ephesus. He is the top civic leader in the city. And he's the one directly responsible to the Roman officials that were headquartered in Ephesus. And he had to give an account to them, and he kept in touch with them about what was going on in the city. And so the town clerk, he was the most influential person here. And he gives his own address now in the theater to this group of people. And actually, his address is more powerful than Demetrius. The more effective. He succeeds in quieting the crowd down. They were all worked up. Notice how he does it. Very, very good at what he did. First of all, the first thing he does, men of Ephesus, who is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is the temple keeper of the great Artemis? They actually found an inscription in Ephesus with that on it, that the city was the temple keeper of the great Artemis. And of the sacred stone that fell from the sky or fell from heaven. This was a very winning argument that he begins with here, with the city. He's appealing to the pride of the city, that they were the keepers of this great temple and of this image that fell from heaven. You see, Artemis is in a different category. Artemis is not a carved image made by hands. It fell from the sky. So that's a very good thing that he was saying to them if he's trying to win their hearing, win their support. So this is a good way that he begins to argue with the crowd in order to quiet them down, to get their attention. But he warns against rash behavior. Verse 36, seeing then that these things cannot be denied, what? Well, that the temple is the great temple of Artemis, that the stone fell from the sky, her statue fell from the sky. He says, look, Artemis is in known danger. That's what this means. Don't worry about it. Artemis is in no danger, in spite of what Demetrius said. He's going to be fine. She, the goddess. Everybody stay calm. Don't do anything rash. Verse 37, for you have brought these men here who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. There's another argument. Paul and his colleagues, they haven't committed any crime. They haven't robbed the temple. They haven't blasphemed our deity. They haven't desecrated our sacred space in the temple. And then he makes this appeal, and he names Demetrius, which probably by naming him in verse 38, it's a rebuke to him publicly, public rebuke. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open. In other words, this unruly mob is not the way to deal with this situation. Take it to the courts. Go through a legal, orderly court if you have charges to bring against them. Not like you're doing now. Verse 39. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly. See, he's being totally reasonable with them. He's making them realize this is not the way to approach this. If you have an issue, a charge against these men, then do it in the fashion that is legal and completely right and just. Every person is entitled to due process. And that's what I hear him saying. But then he adds this, verse 40. And this is an argument that caps it off, that really stops them in their tracks. For we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today. What he's referring to, Ephesus was the headquarters of the Roman officials, too. And he was responsible to them. And one of the things that the Romans frowned on were tumultuous crowds. When this happened, this is what brought about the destruction of Jerusalem, in part, was the rioting of the Jewish people over their uprisings over a period of time. And then they had enough and they went in and destroyed the temple and the whole city, and massacre thousands of Jewish people. The Romans were not going to take this. This was the surest way for them to lose their privileges as a free city, Ephesus. Because they would charge him with rioting, he says. And he says, since there's no cause that we can give to justify this commotion, clearly we understand what he means there. It was not a justified assembly, what they were doing. So he successfully quieted the crowd down, brought them under control to think rationally about the situation. So then the chapter ends with him dismissing the assembly, and everybody goes home. Had a good ending. Nobody was beaten. Aristarchus and Gaius, they were dragged off, so they could have suffered, but they didn't. So that's the end of chapter 19. Let me mention a few things as we conclude. First of all, let's just be reminded of the fact that sometimes the servants of the Lord Jesus Christ are called to minister in environments that are anything but friendly. You know, I'm happy I'm in a friendly environment right now. I would not like to be ministering in a place where my life was in danger. But there are people who are called to a ministry like that. And we have to be prepared because things could turn even in our country and turn against us. You know, the context for Jesus' statement, those who confess me before men, I will confess before my Father. But those who deny me before men, I will deny before my Father in heaven. Now, people have taken that and they've used that as a basis for giving an invitation and calling people to the front to profess Christ. And they quote those verses. That's not what Jesus is talking about. Those verses are in the context of Matthew chapter 10 when he sent the disciples out into the world as sheep among wolves. Where he says, don't fear those who can kill your body and can do no more, but fear him who can cast both body and soul into Gehenna. The context of denying Christ or confessing Christ is in a context when it's dangerous to do so. That's the real test. Can I confess Christ when it might cost me my life? That's what Jesus meant. If you deny me before men, I will deny you before my Father. If you confess me before men, I will confess you before my Father. Something else that jumps out at us in this passage is the Apostle Paul, he preached in Ephesus like he did in Athens, with discretion and wisdom. We don't read in either of those chapters, 17 or in 19, of Paul berating their deities by name. He didn't denounce their practices, per se, with respect to Artemis. Paul was courteous in denouncing idolatry, but he did it from the broad principles that would resonate with everybody. What is the broad principle? Gods made with hands are not gods. So you take that as the broad principle of monotheism against idolatry. And Paul could, and people would think, well, we have made a god made with hands. But he didn't say anything nasty and negative about Artemis. At least it's not recorded. And I want to give Paul credit for that. Because there's some preachers who seem to go out of their way to insult people. You know, like throw sand in their face and say something very insulting, very unwise, that immediately arouses a person's ire against them. Paul was, he was smart about it because his goal was to win people. It gave him no pleasure to see people get mad at him because he insulted them and then become a martyr for Jesus in his thinking. No, he wasn't like that. So, you know, in our witnessing, this is why I say we got to try to understand what people think, what their viewpoint is, what their belief system is, and respect it. Listen to it, respect it, and then try to apply the Christian faith according to where they're at. And do that in gentleness, with meekness. So I love that about Paul, how he was like that in preaching in these heathen cities. And then the final thing I want you to note here is the providence of God, how his providence overrules things. Now this town clerk, for example, and the Asiarchs for that matter, and then this individual, the town clerk, this very powerful man in Ephesus with a lot of influence, who had ties with the Roman government, how he worked on Paul's behalf. This man was a defender of the Christian movement in Ephesus in a roundabout way. And God used him to protect Paul and Aristarchus and Gaius. And that is, it's a testimony to the way God works in our world. He works behind the scenes. He works in people's minds. Yeah, and as I was thinking about this, I thought of a real good illustration from church history from the life of Martin Luther, the famous German reformer. So after Luther was excommunicated from the church, Roman Catholic Church, Frederick the Wise, known as the Elector of Saxony, he was one of seven princes that were responsible for choosing who was going to sit on the throne of the Holy Roman Empire. And they had a lot of clout with the emperor and the pope. Frederick the Wise was the founder of Wittenberg University, who later hired Luther to teach theology there in 1512. And it said they may never have met, but Frederick the Wise took an interest in his professor of theology. And when Luther, after he was excommunicated, Frederick the Wise appealed to the emperor, Charles V, the 21-year-old emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, he appealed to him to give Luther a hearing before just denouncing him as a heretic. And he agreed, and so that was the basis for then the, quote, the Diet of Worms that you've heard about in 1521. Great year for Martin Luther. The Diet of Worms, not the Diet of Worms, the Diet at Worms. Worms is a city. Diet means like an imperial council, a legislative body that comes together. Over 200 dignitaries from all over Europe came together from the church and from the state for the Diet of Worms to hear Luther's defense. Frederick the Wise provided a safe escort for Luther when he came into Worms. He needed it. There were people all along the street wanting to see this monk who dared to challenge the world's greatest power. And then, after he gave his great presentation in defense, Luther, on his way back to Wittenberg, they staged a kidnapping and whisked him off to Wartburg Castle to preserve him. And it was due to Frederick the Wise. He engineered all of that to protect Luther. So it was an amazing story about him. This is how God can work. This is how God can operate in the mind and heart of a person to protect Christ's servants. He did it in a beautiful way. And finally, a couple of verses here concerning God, that he stills the roaring of the seas, the roaring of the waves, and then check this, the tumult of the people. God quiets it. He alone has the power to quiet the roaring of the waves and the tumult of the people, which God did through the city clerk, the town clerk at Ephesus. This was God's hand in this affair. This is God working behind the scenes. And I think it's a beautiful testimony. Has God changed? Does he still work this way in the world? Oh, he does. He is the Lord. I change not, he says. I change not. Yahweh is the same God operating today in the world, the same as he did back then. So may the Lord bless this portion of his word and give us a greater sense of God's involvement in the affairs, not only of the world in general, but in our own lives. Are you aware of God working in your life? When was the last time you prayed and saw an answer to prayer? Maybe you don't pray. Maybe you don't have any relationship to God. Maybe today could be the day when you decide to turn to the Lord. Whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. That's the promise. When I first heard that, when I was a lost teenager, that was like a life preserver thrown to me. When I couldn't tread water and I was going under and somebody threw a life preserver to me, it was that verse, Romans 10:9. Whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved.
Thank you for joining us and listening to this message from the Ministry of Grace Providence Church in Cerritos, California. For more information, visit our website at www.graceprovidencechurch.org.